The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2002, I did my only interview with a writer who had just written a book about one of the early aviators, a gentleman who was one of the major rivals of the Wright brothers, but he hadn't wanted it to be that way. Glenn Hammond Curtis really wanted to work with the Wright brothers, but they weren't interested, and he became one of the leading aviators and one of the leading aircraft manufacturers, despite the fact that the Wright brothers really didn't want anything to do with him. And the story of Glenn Hammond Curtis is also very much a story of the Wrights, as you'll find out from listening to my interview with Seth Shulman as we talked about his book, Unlocking the Sky, Glenn Hammond Curtis and the Race to Invent the Airplane.
On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie. Oh, where shall I fly? Oh, where shall morning rapture sing and rises to my side.
Sweet fields. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest today on the program is Seth Shulman. His book is Unlocking the Sky, Glenn Hammond Curtis and the Race to Invent the Airplane. What do you mean, Glenn Hammond Curtis? You mean the Wright brothers, don't you?
No, indeed. No, this is the Wright brothers are in this book, but this tells a bit of a different story about the first 10 years of the airplane than a lot of people know.
I'll say they're in it. They're in it a lot.
Yeah.
Who was Glenn Hammond Curtis? I remember there was a Curtis airplane. Was it the Jenny?
Right. If anybody's ever heard of Curtis at all, they probably heard of the Jenny, probably one of the more successful as a two-seater airplane. One of the more successful airplanes of all time. But Glenn Curtis, my book focuses mostly on the very early days of aviation. And this is a guy who was the first to publicly demonstrate an airplane in America, the first to sell an airplane in this country, the first to fly from one American city to another. And his is the name that's on the very first pilot license that was issued in America. He was not the first to fly, as people around here probably know. That was the Wright brothers. But what people might not remember is that there was a period of some 4.5 years after Kitty Hawk when the Wright brothers refused to demonstrate their airplane. And initially, that was the first couple of years were spent trying to get a patent. But the patent was issued within 2 years, and then another 2.5 years go by, and they're still not demonstrating their airplane. People were saying they're either flyers or liars. And in this period, these 4.5 years, the airplane was born. It burst onto the scene both here and in Europe. And that's why Glenn Curtis has the distinction of actually being the first to demonstrate that a plane could fly. He did it in upstate New York on July 4th, 1908. And for that, he won the big prize of the day, which was called the Scientific American Trophy, which was for the first plane that could show that it could fly a kilometer in the sky.
You start the book off by talking about a guy named Langley. Now, yeah. He's important in this story, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, Samuel Langley was the head of the Smithsonian Institution. And very important for a number of reasons. I decided, here it's a book mostly about Glenn Curtis, but I decided to devote some time and start off with Samuel Langley for a number of reasons. First of all, he was really one of the very first eminent scientists of his day who believed that a flying machine was possible. At the time, there were a number of people who were interested, but there weren't people of his stature who really believed in it. And in fact, the Wright brothers, throughout, always said that it was that effort that he put in and that belief that he had that really helped inspire them along the way. And when they started out, they wrote away to him, because by that time, he had done some really extraordinary work to help make the airplane a reality. And one of the things he'd done is made models that were half to three-quarter scale models. They were not manned flying machines, but they were driven by engines, and he could have those things fly down the Potomac River, because he was based in Washington, for upwards of three-quarters of a mile. And to a scientist like him, basically, he wrote at that time that, as far as he was concerned, he had proven that mechanical flight was possible, and he was not a young man at that time, and by that time, he said, it would probably be he'd look to someone else to actually develop the commercial possibilities. As it turned out, Langley was called upon by the government to try and develop a prototype. He got government funding, sort of a secret military project. And when he tried to scale up the airplane, it did not fly. It careened into the Potomac. And for that, he was just pilloried in the press. On the floor of the House, they said the only thing this guy made fly was government money. And the New York Times editorialized at that point that it'd be probably another 10 million years before anybody would fly. And of course, this was 2 weeks before Kitty Hawk. So he took a real beating. And I start off with his failed flight for a number of reasons. It becomes very important in the story because I try and make it sort of an exciting narrative. But the other thing is, I think it's important for people to know right from the start that I had always sort of thought that the Wright brothers just sort of came out of these earnest bicycle builders that kind of built the airplane out of whole cloth. But in fact, there was a very active group of people trying to develop the airplane for a long time. And while Langley's efforts were always written down as being a failure, in fact, I think when you look back, we're nearly hitting the 100th anniversary now, one of the amazing things is to see how close he really did come. And that's a lot of what that plays into the story. Glenn Curtis plays a role in showing just how close he did come.
And their ears are perking up out there at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I know we have a lot of listeners out there. The book is Unlocking the Sky, Glenn Hammond Curtis and the Race to Invent the Airplane. My guest is Seth Shulman. The Wright brothers and Glenn Hammond Curtis have so much in common, and yet they are so different. Here we have guys who love bicycles, who are involved in bicycle manufacture. Glenn Hammond Curtis becomes a bicycle racer. They're really into that, and they love trying to figure out how to fly, yet Glenn is very open about everything, and the Wright brothers are very close. Glenn wants his planes to be very colorful and eye-catching. The Wright brothers paint their plane gray so you can't photograph it, so you can't see it. They're hiding out over there on Huffman Prairie.
Absolutely right. And very interesting with a lot of echoes for today when you see the progress of science and technology. I became absolutely fascinated with this guy, Glenn Curtis. The more I learned about him, the more at odds his story seemed with what little I knew about the origin of the airplane. But I also, the further in I got, the more I became impressed with his approach to the technology. I think you're absolutely right. You know, they both came out of rural America, pretty much. He was from upstate New York, and the Wright brothers were from here in the Midwest. And they did have many, many similarities. In fact, people at the time said that when you saw them together, they could almost be brothers. He was a little younger, but they had a lot of the same characteristics all the way around. The mystery to me is, you know, again, not to detract from the incredible accomplishment of the Wright brothers, because they did put that final piece of the jigsaw puzzle together and got a plane off the ground before anyone else, and nothing can take that away. But what's really interesting to me is that I think we forget essentially half of the Wright brothers' story. And while they started off much true to the sort of mythology, I think, the earnest young bicycle builders, once they had that success, they became desperately afraid that someone was going to steal the airplane out from under them. And it caused them, I think, to do things that with hindsight we can say were really mistaken on every level, because it didn't turn out to be good for their business. It didn't turn out to be good for anything. And one of the things they did is they tried to literally shut down the competition, got involved in a 9-year legal battle with Glenn Curtis, which is one of the reasons we don't remember him as much, because they had a lot of success prosecuting that lawsuit. And it was really unfortunate. I think it hurt aviation in this country in the early years, without any question. It's one of the reasons why planes in Europe were there was so much more dynamic changes to the technology once it sort of started going in Europe rather than here. Again, you've got to remember this is the age of monopoly. The Wright brothers looked around. They were outsiders. They saw people like Langley. They saw they maybe didn't know exactly how to operate in this, but they also saw Alexander Graham Bell had a monopoly on the telephone. You had the Rockefellers or whatever, and they saw an opportunity to get that kind of monopoly on the airplane, and came remarkably close, especially in this country, to doing that. And unfortunately, the way they did that is just by being very reluctant to license their technology to anybody and prosecuting anybody who tried to get an airplane off the ground. And their most formidable competitor of the day was Glenn Curtis, and he bore the big brunt of those lawsuits.
And they really gave him special attention. And we have Wilbur Wright dying very young. And afterwards, Orville really kind of freaks out, doesn't he? Didn't he go so far as to accuse Curtis of having something to do with his brother dying?
Yes, in fact, he did. In a very prominent interview in the New York Times, he went outright, basically said that accused Curtis of having killed his brother. His brother died of typhoid fever, but Orville's reasoning was that he never would have come down with typhoid fever if he hadn't been so upset about Curtis and having to spend so much time carrying on the lawsuits and everything else. And the fact is that that is a sort of an interesting piece of the story, that Orville Wright never really got over his brother's death, I don't think, and just became embittered against Curtis. And it became a feud that really hurt the industry, as I said before, but also just sort of puts a interesting and sort of controversial veil over the whole early days of aviation, became very partisan and bitter from the start, and became not even so much a question of this guy competing or making an airplane. I mean, they did not want Curtis in the air. It wasn't really just a matter of getting royalties from him. After a while, it just became a matter of trying to shut him down. And in fact, they did contribute to him becoming bankrupted. But the thing about Curtis that's so amazing, aside from his being open and collaborating with everyone and being so well-loved in the field of aviation, is that he was just so perseverant. It seems like nothing kept that guy down. And it's one of the reasons why today he's credited with some 500 seminal innovations to the airplane. Things like retractable landing gear, he was the first to put that on his airplane, one of the very first to have an enclosed cockpit, the flaps on the back of the wings. The lawsuit with the Wright brothers was all about, this is another kind of sad and interesting thing, that many years later, the Wright brothers' patent, as many people around here may well know, involved warping the wings of their plane. It was a wing warping patent. And through that twisting of the wings, they would retain lateral control of the airplane so that it could bank on a turn without keeling over. Now, from the very start, Curtis and his team used ailerons, the flaps that soon became the industry standard. And so one of the ironic things is while this lawsuit dragged on, the wing warping that was at the heart of the Wright's claim to the airplane really had already become obsolete, even though their planes were largely still using it. Most of the other planes were not. And the whole lawsuit centered on the fact that having flaps encroached on their patented rights. And I think today, especially when you look back, and having gone over the patents and looked at it, I just don't think this is something that would pass muster today. And I still have a little trouble wondering how it did in the first place. The idea is, and even at the time, very many prominent lawyers of the day also sided with Curtis, that because they were what they called supplemental surfaces, additional little wings, the flaps, that they weren't covered by the idea of twisting a wing, that it served the same purpose largely to retain lateral control, but it got there by a different method. And that's what Curtis argued throughout. And the argument, I think, looks pretty good today. And so it's sort of a shame that so much time and effort just tying up the early aviation industry was spent on this, I think.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back 20 years to an interview I did with Seth Shulman talking about the aviator Glenn Hammond Curtis. And we'll have more right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. 20 years ago, I talked to Seth Shulman about his biography of the early aviator Glenn Hammond Curtis. It's very much his story, but also the story of the Wright brothers. Let's listen. If it weren't for the fact that the Wright brothers were so darn stubborn and so into being control freaks and being closed about what they were doing, these guys could have worked together. In fact, you talk about how they met, and Curtis was in Dayton with a dirigible?
Yeah. The way Curtis got into aviation is through his work on motorcycles. Like the Wright brothers, he had a bicycle shop. He's a bicycle builder, one of the early bicycle builders to put a motor on the bikes and started up having a very popular brand of motorcycle and perfected. In fact, one of the things that one of his many accomplishments is Curtis is credited with inventing the handlebar throttle that we now find on virtually every single motorcycle in the world, which, supposedly the story goes a customer was just twisting the handlebar grip on a bicycle one day and this light bulb went off in his head and he ran in and the next thing you know he had it kind of figured out. The fact is, by the turn of the century or so, Curtis was making some of the very best lightweight motors of the day. So much so that they were recognized by all these people as being exactly what they needed to get something off the ground because they were powerful and they were light. And in fact, his engine designs were even the Wright brothers admitted that was not their strong point, and they were undoubtedly better motors, I think, than those of the Wright brothers at the time. But one of the very first ways he started getting pulled in is through the craze for dirigibles, which are basically powered balloons with hydrogen inside of them. And
incredibly dangerous.
incredibly dangerous in every way. But before the airplane came along, there was this brief period of several years where these were the flying machines of the day. And the best ones, especially in the U.S., were powered by Curtis engines. And in fact, there was this really colorful figure who's in the book. His name was Thomas Baldwin. And he was a former circus performer who had traveled around the world showing off dirigibles of different kinds that he had helped to build. Had performed in Europe and gotten a ring from the Queen of England and gone to Asia and wild, huge crowds turning out to see him fly. And he came to Dayton. And the Wright brothers didn't usually go to these things, but even they turned out to see Baldwin fly in his dirigible. And because he was going to be down here for a few days, he asked Curtis to come to maintain the motor. And that was when Curtis first met the Wright brothers. And there's just a wonderful story because it was a windy day. Curtis advised Baldwin not to go up because he knew that they might overpower the engine, but Baldwin saw the size of the paying crowds and decided he'd go up anyway. And of course, the dirigible gets blown out of control, and a whole lot of people went running after it, and among them were Curtis and Wilbur Wright, and that's literally when they first met. And after that, they went back and met in the shop. And Curtis corresponded with the Wrights for quite some time and offered to, for instance, give them some of his motors for free and was very interested in the possibility of collaborating. But they never showed the airplane to him, and they never had any interest in collaborating with him at all, even from the start. But it's interesting, especially to see how this kind of bitter feud ended up happening. They became very jealous of the successes that Curtis had, but initially, especially, he was very open to working with them just the way he was with everybody. That was really pretty much the way he approached the technology. And, you know, all these years later, I think it kind of puts him in a good light. It really holds up. I worked very hard to sort of try and find out the dirt about this guy, and everybody who worked with him really admired him. He became his company ultimately when they started making the Jennies. Of course, his company became very large, but he was always the kind of manager that would get out on the shop floor, was always really interested in working in teams. And even though he was a real mechanical genius, he always would incorporate the suggestions and, you know, worked really well with others so that they felt that they were kind of part of the effort that was making things happen.
What a time. The golden age of inventors. We've got guys like Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, Henry Ford. A lot of these guys are involved in this story.
They are. I mean, one of the really fun things about working on this was the way Curtis is his life intersected with so many of the giants of the period. He worked early on with Alexander Graham Bell to make his very first airplane. Henry Ford came in and took his side in the lawsuit against the Wrights and actually gave his very prominent lawyer and legal staff to Curtis to help fight off the Wrights' continuing lawsuit. Yeah, he had a really fascinating life, and it was a really interesting time. And, you know, the thing to remember about 100 years ago is that the telephone was still pretty new. The car had just come along. Airplanes were bursting onto the scene. You had the birth of motion pictures. The world was just changing dramatically with the advent of these new technologies, and it was an unsettling time because of that. People were making fortunes and often losing them, and it's a time that has, I think, many echoes of some of the period that we've been, you know, you mentioned Bill Gates with Microsoft, but think of how technologies changed our lives, and a lot of times it takes some time for those kinds of changes to settle out, not just in the business side in terms of who's going to control it, but in the lives of the people there. And so one of the fun things was to try and put myself back into imagining how it would be to see some of these very early flights. The first time you'd ever seen an airplane fly, it was an unthinkable thing. And the wonderful thing is that there are many written accounts from the period. The first time when Curtis made that demonstration, the first public demonstration of an airplane in America, there were a number of people on hand who wrote accounts of it that I quote from in that chapter, and they're incredible to try and remember what that must have been like. And along those lines, maybe one of the most incredible of all was, I had mentioned earlier that Curtis was the very first to make a flight from one American city to another. He flew from Albany to Manhattan. And at the time, this is several years, the airplane had been flying around, but for the most part, it was kind of like those dirigibles. It was something that people would either pay to see, or there'd be a meet where the airplane would get off the ground and it would fly around and land, and people would be amazed that it could do those kinds of things. The idea of flying 150 miles along the Hudson River over sort of uncharted terrain, and certainly for the air, and using a plane in that way was absolutely just a revelation to people. And I think in that one flight did more than almost anything else that I can think of, in this country at least, to really give people a sense that the airplane was more than just a fabulous new toy, that it was really going to be a practicable machine. Among the many things, he delivered a letter, for instance, from the mayor of Albany to the mayor of New York. And thousands upon thousands of people turned out all along the Hudson to watch him fly. And in fact, the New York Times devoted, just to give you a sense of the scale of how important this was, they devoted 6 pages of text and pictures to this. It was more than they'd ever given to any news event prior. So it was a huge contribution right there, just to sort of psychologically getting people's arms essentially around the idea that an airplane could be a useful thing for transporting people.
just in the last couple of years, the Miami Valley has literally been crawling with authors doing research on the Wright brothers, working on books for the Centennial of Flight next year. In fact, a good friend of mine is writing a book about it, and he's working on it right now. He's been doing all kinds of research. Reading your book, we get such a different view of the Wright brothers than the one that we're typically accustomed to hearing. They're heroes to us here in the Miami Valley, and I don't think it makes them seem unheroic, but there's a manipulative side of them that I don't think really comes through in a lot of other works. In fact, one particular example is how they controlled the information about someone seeing the plane fly in Kitty Hawk and where that was published. That was fascinating.
Yeah. It's hard history to untangle. And you have to kind of do it in bits and pieces. And I bet some of these people doing their research on the Wright brothers will find out more. There's still some stuff that's coming out, but there is no question that that one thing that I just don't buy that's in the sort of standard mythology about the Wright brothers is a lot of historians will say that because of Langley's experience, where he was so lampooned for the idea of trying to make an airplane, that the Wright brothers were kind of afraid that they'd get bad press, or that they were somehow shy about, or that maybe the press was just ignoring it because they thought the Wright brothers were a bunch of cranks. I don't think any of those things are true. I think the fact of the matter is, and there's a lot of evidence to show, that the Wright brothers, especially in that 4.5-year period that I talked about, were just incredibly guarded about who they would ever let see or know about their work. And even from the very first start, there was controversy about the way that they even let any word go out that they had flown. And there's some correspondence between the brothers that indicates that when press came, as they did come and they wanted to find out about it, that they actually pretended that the plane wouldn't fly so that they, that they wouldn't have to ever show it. Now, in the course of the lawsuit, a number of different things come out, and they make the case that, well, they did show it to people. Certain people had witnessed it when they rode in trains around here, but the fact is, the more you look into it, you can find, as you were talking about, the links that they went to try and shut it down. In fact, there's one story where an editor from the local paper came out because he'd heard rumors about what they were doing, and they not only, according to one account, tried to buy out a lot of the local papers when they...
It was the Dayton Journal. They bought every copy, didn't they?
they bought out the copies, but they also, and much more importantly, used their connections to try and suppress it from going out on the wire. They definitely cared deeply about how they were going to be represented and about who, they did try and control who might know about it. But what's very fascinating is, for instance, you see a lot of correspondence from there was this trophy out there, the big trophy of the day, the Scientific American Trophy, the trophy, in fact, that Glenn Curtis wins. They issued it three times. At first, it was just to fly a kilometer, and they kept sort of upping it, and this was the big prize in America. And behind the scenes, the editor of Scientific American was quietly writing away to the Wright brothers, look, if you've got this plan, you're talking about it, we'd love to have you, we'll meet you anytime, any place, come and you can demonstrate it for us, and we'll give you the trophy, basically. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. And they took that same attitude about almost all of the early venues, including the first international air meet that took place in France. They wouldn't participate in that. Didn't participate in the Louisiana exhibition. So people had heard enough about the rumors that the Wright brothers had flown, and a lot of people tried to urge them to get into it. Even those friends that they had, people like Octave Chanute, who was something of a mentor to the Wright brothers, encouraged them to just go out. Look, there's prize money. Why not? What's the downside of it? It's hard to understand, I think, exactly what their motivation was to keep things so clamped down. And maybe some of those biographies that you're talking about that will be in the pipeline now for next year will give us even more clues.
It's the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 20 years for an interview I did with Seth Shulman talking about his biography of the early aviator Glenn Hammond Curtis. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. And we'll bring you our final segment with Seth Shulman right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2002 interview with Seth Shulman. We talked a lot about Glenn Hammond Curtis, the subject of his biography, and quite a bit about the Wright brothers.
Their motivations seem to have been fairly altruistic to begin with. In fact, they even said they didn't really foresee any money coming out of this. And once they had it, once they had the invention, they kept it under wraps. Their motivations seemed to change. Clearly, they were hoping that the military would be able to utilize this invention and that maybe there was some money in it, but they needed to protect the information.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that that a lot of it had to do with their outsider status and with this kind of real paranoia that someone was going to steal it away from them. And but, you know, the funny thing was they were not really a known quantity. They sort of had this idea that they could just go in to the U.S. military, for instance, and say, hey, guys, we've made a flying machine. And they tried this. They tried this with the French government. They had terrible success. Their first business plan was essentially to sell some of the rights in a very big deal to a government. But they didn't really know how to do it. They were kind of rebuffed initially by the U.S. government because they didn't even really sort of send it to the right guy. And then they immediately started going out to other governments. But always they ran into the same problem, which is the governments or their representatives would say, well, that's neat, so show us what you got. Oh, no. they were just supposed to trust these two unknown bicycle builders from Dayton that they had this invention that was going to change the world. And I think, you know, and that ultimately... That ultimately hurt them, no question about it, and it hurt the Wright company. And it's something also that's so notably different with a guy like Curtis, who, because he had started kind of collaborating with groups from the start, those things were never an issue to him. And you know, he said to his colleague at one time that he thought the best thing, he had a lot of patents by this time, but he never used his patents in the way that the Wright brothers did to sort of try and shut out the competition. And he told his colleague that he thought the best thing was probably just to forget about the patents and go for the business. And his goal was always to build the best airplanes that he could. And he built incredible airplanes. And people within aviation, even at the time, pretty much all along felt that his airplanes were the best of the day. And again, that's something else that I think just all these years later really stands up. He'd probably want to just be judged by his airplanes, and they hold up well. The Jenny's just one of many that he made. That they were innovative. When they had that very first international air meet, for instance, it was Curtis's little plane that he brought over on the boat, never having been to Europe before, that beat all the other planes of the day, flew faster than any other one. He was the real thing. He had the, you know, I think in my estimation, he belongs in that pantheon of great inventors of that period, up there with people like Edison and Alexander Graham Bell. His contribution was enormous, and that's why it was kind of a pleasure to tell his story, aside from the fact that it's just a you know, fabulously adventurous story, too. I mean, aside from being an inventor, a lot of people were inventors. You got Edison in the lab making a light bulb. This is a guy who combined some of that mechanical genius with a real... He wasn't a daredevil, but he was an incredible pilot and got up into these... The planes, some of the planes still survive, and there are replicas of them, and these flimsy planes made out of bamboo and cloth to pilot these things and to embark on a lot of the adventures that he had. He also had a lot of daring.
We get a psychological profile, in a way, of Orville Wright. After his brother dies, these are guys who never married. Orville, in fact, really stopped flying completely. Wilbur, I understand, was the one who did most of the flying, but Orville did some flying. Orville stopped flying. He got completely obsessed with litigation, and their mother had died when they were very young, and he had a very close relationship with his sister, who then he felt betrayed him by getting married, and then she died shortly after that, and he just almost disowned her, didn't he?
Well, they never talked too much after she got married at age 52 or something like that. Yeah, you know, that's true. I do try and use it as a lens to talk about the way we remember things and to talk about the first 10 years of aviation and to talk about the Wright brothers to some extent as well. And there's no question that that Orville had trouble getting over the death of his brother. And everything you said is right. He did not fly an airplane after 1914, didn't get in an airplane after 1918. Meanwhile, lived a very long life. So a lot of that later life was spent pretty much as a recluse, pretty much out of the business. And of course, this is mostly beyond the sort of the scope of the central narrative that I tell in the book. But it is sort of sad. I think a lot of his work was devoted to with an eye to posterity about how the Wright brothers ensuring that their work as the first to fly would always be sort of indelibly burnt into our memory. And I think, you know, I think he deserves some credit for success in that. He was very dedicated to that proposition. And if anybody ever wrote anything that in any way diverged from that or gave credit to other people for doing different parts of it, he would write angry letters or he made it very much his business to ensure that a certain kind of story would be told if he had anything to say about it. Curtis, for his part, died well before Orville does, but he took a different attitude. I think as the aviation industry really got going, he soon realized that it was being taken over by a class of engineers that just knew an awful lot more than he ever did. And while he kept a hand in and was a manager for a while, he soon sort of phased out. But he flew, continued to fly, and continued to keep in touch with people in the field. The interesting thing about the Wright brothers, another thing that I think is disturbing along the same lines is, you know, it wasn't just his break with his sister, but probably the central and most telling break that happened was with this guy, Octave Chanute. Now, Octave Chanute was arguably the father of aviation in this country. He was kind of a one-man clearinghouse. He was an engineer who built a lot of railroad bridges, made a lot of money, and like Samuel Langley, believed that an airplane was possible at a time when most people didn't, and wrote an early book slightly before the turn of the century called Progress in Flying Machines, where he chronicled the work of some 65 different researchers making glider and airplane designs. He wouldn't just keep track of what all these people around the world were doing. He would correspond with them, and he would encourage them, and he made it his business. In fact, he was the big early proponent of the biplane, having the two wings, one on top of the other. And one of the reasons that you have all those early planes, most all of them, as biplanes, is that they were just following the lessons laid out in Chanute's book, Progress in Flying Machines. The Wright brothers read that book, just in the same way that they went to Langley. And in fact, it was Chanute who recommended that they go out to a windy place on the coast. Basically, he's almost picking out Kitty Hawk as a location for them, helped them in all sorts of ways. And then when the Wright brothers started moving into their secretive phase where they weren't sharing with anyone, it was Chanute who spoke out and said, you know, you guys have benefited so much from all the work of others. You know, you really owe it to people to demonstrate your plan and to share more of your technology. And the correspondence, they corresponded a lot. And it's very sad to see because basically Chanute ends up dying before they ever really reconciled. Again, you know, that kind of relationship was paralleled in a lot of the key relationships that the Wright brothers had. So by the time he became an old man, Orville's world really, I think, had kind of closed in, and he had sort of parted company with a lot of the people who had supported him early on, partly just because, again, of this litigious nature and the role that they played in those in that first decade of flight.
And this litigious nature, as you indicated, could have gone on longer were it not for World War I.
Yes, and World War I comes along, and the United States needs planes for the war effort. And so what ends up happening is that the government steps in and requires the Wright brothers to cross-license their technology. this is where the Jenny comes in. And immediately, Curtis's airplane company becomes the largest manufacturer in the country. Again, testament to the fact that the guy was building the best airplanes of the day. So ultimately, there's a kind of a happy ending for Glenn Curtis, although I think really in some ways some of the most exciting parts of the story, and to me the most inspiring parts of his story, are the way he persevered against adversity mm-hmm. in all those years when the Wright brothers were doing everything they could to keep this guy down, basically, and to keep his airplanes out of the sky, trying to prohibit him not only from selling airplanes but even exhibiting them. And despite all of that, he remained a cheerful guy who just was determined and kind of obsessed with just building airplanes, and would always find a way to keep going. And I just came to love that side of him. It's something that I still find it very inspiring. Just talking about it now. Would that we were all that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I must say this book goes a long way to helping to balance some of the glorified image that we have of the birth of aviation, and here in the Dayton area. People get upset when they see North Carolina license plates, it's a very much of a personal sense of ownership of the Wright brothers and of aviation. And I think that you've done an excellent job of just giving us some other things to look at, some other things to digest and to savor. Tell us about yourself and the other things that you do. We were chatting before we went on the air.
I'm mostly a journalist. I write about contemporary things, mostly science and technology. This is I've written a fair number of magazine-length historical pieces, but this is the first time that I really delved in at book length into a historical subject. My interest in sort of chronicling technology and I think served me pretty well for going back. It certainly was an education for me to see how many things, even though many things have changed, how many things remain the same. I'm hoping that it will help now coming back and getting back to some of that writing about current things. It gives you kind of an interesting perspective. My goal here is not in any way to really take away from the Wright brothers. I think people around here should feel that sense of pride for their accomplishments. But I think in my looking back, nearly 100 years later at the birth of the airplane, it reinforced my sense that technology's kind of percolate up. It's not, we're always obsessed with sort of the first person to do something and giving credit and apportioning credit. A lot of my writing has to do with patent fights today and other kinds of fights over intellectual property. And I think that when you look back with all that benefit of hindsight, you can see that many, many people over the course of probably nearly 100 years or even more contributed a lot to the development of the airplane. And rather than just seeing all those previous contributions as failures, it's kind of nice to go back and really say, well, even if they didn't make a flying airplane or an airplane that flew with a person in it or an airplane that flew that far, in other ways, they might have inspired others, or they might have contributed a part of it that people said, huh, well, this thing didn't work, but, that aspect of what they did gives me a great idea. And that's really a lot the way technology evolves. And it was nice to be able to, it's something that's occurred to me in my writing about contemporary stuff when you have people fighting over computer software or genes or whatever it might be. It gave me a nice perspective about it. It's such a nice, tangible story about the airplane. It's my hope that you don't have to be any kind of aviation buff to enjoy this story. But by looking at some of those bits and pieces, I think it is a nice nice perspective on the way technological change happens.
And you've been listening to the best of the Book Nook. Seth Shulman recorded 20 years ago, talking about his biography, Unlocking the Sky, Glenn Hammond Curtis, and the race to invent the airplane. Don't miss the Book Nook tomorrow. I'll be doing my third interview with George Dawes Green at 10:30 tomorrow morning. And we do our interviews widely spaced apart. Back in 1994,
George published his first novel, The Caveman's Valentine. The following year, in 1995, I interviewed him for his book, The Juror. And then he didn't put out another book for 14 years. In 2009, I finally got my second interview with George to talk about his novel, Ravens. And after all these years, 13 more years, he's put out a third novel. It's called The Kingdoms of Savannah, and it is good stuff. I want to read you a little excerpt from it. This is from chapter 1. Ransom Musgrove has been summoned to the house of his youth, the Romanesque revival mansion from the 1880s that everyone calls the Old Fort, on account of the parapet and the grand turret and the gargoyles and all the ivied brickwork. As he comes up the walk, he gets flashes from his boyhood. Under that pecan, first kiss with Debbie Gannon. Under the crepe myrtle, third base with Luann Ferris. And up in the brown turkey fig tree, wasn't there some death match with his big brother David? He has a vague memory of David taunting him, and Ransom getting so mad he went for David's throat and forgot to hold on to the limb. He doesn't recall what happened next. Then, at the front steps, he has one more memory. 13 years old, standing out here awaiting the carpool to school and daydreaming when his mother appeared on the balcony. Although it was a bright sunny morning, she was drunk. Clearly, she'd been out partying the night before and hadn't been to bed yet. She began to disparage him in the third person, one of her favorite pastimes. She said, "Well, the kid dawdles there like an idiot, gathering wool, concocting his little fantasies about how the world should be. The real world keeps marching on, doesn't it? Clomp, 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 crushing his little dreams. Does he even notice? No, he's too stupid. Is he going to be a hobo? Well, yes, that's certain, unless he gets some ambition and starts kiting checks." He hoped that the arrival of the carpool would shut her up, and it did for a moment. Mrs. Tarkanian's big Suburban pulled up, and he squeezed into the second row with two other kids, while Mom, up on that balcony, produced a silk handkerchief and waved it. Mrs. Tarkanian waved back. "Hey, Morgana," his mother said in a loud, tragic voice. "Hey, Laurel. Goodbye, Laurel. Goodbye, my son, who is destined to be a vagabond." Her position when drunk was always, "I'll speak the truth and the public be damned." As the carpool pulled away, he felt his mortification, his jawbone, and his spine, and silently begged for death. However, the other kids made no comment. Maybe they thought she was joking, or they hadn't understood the word. However, years later, a girl who'd been in that car told him she thought it was romantic, scary, but kind of romantic the way your mom stood up on that balcony that day telling the whole neighborhood how you were destined to be a vagabond. It's not lost on him that Morgana's prophecy has come true. Up four steps to the porch to the front door with the spiderweb fanlight and sidelight, and he hasn't even seen her yet, but already he feels the bad juice in his veins and has to remind himself that she summoned him, sending her accountant to find his tent under the Harry S. Truman exit ramp. That he's still a free man, he's 33 years old, and should she try to start anything, to flip any of his switches, he can just turn and walk away. Any time he's so inclined. So, he tells himself. George Dawes Green, from his novel, The Kingdoms of Savannah. And why does it take him so long to put out novels? Because George is kind of busy doing other things. In fact, George is the creator of The Moth. Do you listen to The Moth Radio Hour on WYSO? Well, George is the guy who came up with the idea. The Moth is his baby. They used to tell stories back in Brunswick, Georgia. They would sit on the big screened-in porch in front of his house. They'd sit there and they'd watch the moths come in through the holes in the screen and flitter around the lights. And that's how he got the idea for The Moth. They would sit out there and they would tell stories. And it developed over the years into a very popular public radio program. And a series of books. You might have heard my recent interview with one of his collaborators on The Moth, who's been with the program all these years. Don't miss George Dawes Green. We'll be talking about his new novel, The Kingdoms of Savannah and The Moth. That's coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook at 10:30 tomorrow morning. We bring the Book Nook to you every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, like we did today. And every Sunday morning at 10:30. And they are different shows. They're different programs. I know some of you think, oh, it's a repeat. Nope, different shows. Every Saturday, every Sunday, different shows, two new shows every weekend just for you on your public radio station. The Book Nook is produced right here at WYSO. Thanks for listening.